Hey, welcome to part two of the podcast, looking at legal troubles for bloggers and the problems around that. I'm very glad to have Connie St. Louis here and Richard Wilson. Connie is the head of the Science Journalism MA at City University. She's also a broadcaster and journalist and a member of the Association of British Science Writers. Richard Wilson is the author of Don't Get Fooled Again, The Skeptic's Guide to Life, and he runs an equally sceptical blog of the same name, which has attracted many recent legal rows in the media. And I first came across him when he uncovered oil firm Trafigura as at the heart of The Guardian's mysterious story about a super injunction. That story fast gathered pace, and we've heard lots about that. So let's start with Richard. Richard, you're very good at drawing attention to difficult questions that people want to avoid answering. Do you feel you've taken particularly dangerous legal risks on your blog?
Not especially. I mean, I have at the back of my mind, I know I'm taking some risks, but I don't go looking for trouble. I think it's more a question of, I wrote about certain things in my book, and I started a website so I could talk about some of those things a bit more. And I kind of found that in doing so, it was actually in connection with a book that I got a libel threat, and I was really shocked at the situation when I started looking into it, how easy it was to get sued. And I thought, well, I'm either going to stop or I'm going to try to carry on doing what I was doing anyway. But I've actually just been trying to write about things that interest me and that seem important. I haven't been going out of my way to look for difficulties. And one of the issues for me is that it seems like we're at a point now where people who are just doing that are putting themselves in the line of fire without even having to try very hard.
And was that with your book, your second book, that you got this libel threat?
Yes. It's something that I've only started talking about a little bit more recently, because the threat came in sort of early last year, and the paperback book hadn't yet been published, so I wanted to give it a year until the sort of statute of limitations had passed on the book, because I didn't want to draw any further attention to myself. But basically, I was threatened by somebody who I talked about in a chapter of my book about the asbestos industry. And this is a guy who's presented himself as an expert, and has even been described by a website run by his company as the world's, I'll paraphrase, but essentially the world's greatest authority on asbestos. And I kind of said, well, actually he isn't, and he has two criminal convictions for misrepresenting himself. And I got a very scary libel threat. And it was scary because, as much as anything, my publisher did have something to lose. To a certain extent, I feel I don't really have anything to lose. I would just go bankrupt. But there was someone else who I'd sort of managed to land in trouble, and that was really quite
someone
a shocking
that
experience.
Repeated your allegations.
No, or? My publisher. Sorry.
Oh, I see.
Sort of landed my publisher in trouble, who were lovely people, and I felt really, you know, they'd given me this break. It's only my second book, and I'd landed them in this situation, and it was quite a shocking thing to find, and I think that sort of shaped my approach from then on in.
So, but you didn't, because you said you waited a period before talking about it, so you didn't use your blog as a means of communicating the case, or.
No, because again, there was someone else involved, so I just worked it through very carefully with my publisher. I mean, they were the ones that would probably have suffered most. So we did a formal legal response. I spent a lot of time of my life just working up an answer to say, look, you don't have a case, and here are the footnotes, and, you know, 55 footnotes to show that you don't, and that was all done behind closed doors. But it made me very concerned, very angry about the situation with libel law and freedom of speech in this country. And so I was, in a sense, gravitating towards things like Trafigura as a proxy for the things that I couldn't talk about.
And then what happened? Did it never went to court? Or how did you settle out of court? Or?
It has a very happy ending, I'm proud to say. It never went to court. He sent one more letter, which was just from him. It wasn't from his lawyers, and it was... we weren't very worried by it, I'll put it that way, and nothing ever came of it. But the twist is, he didn't sue me, but he did sue the health and safety executive for some comments that a health and safety executive had allegedly made to two people in a private conversation, and he sued them for slander. and he lost the case. It was thrown out of court for abuse of process. And in the court ruling, which is available online, they said, well, we did a Google search and Richard Wilson had already said lots of other things about you in his book, and there was a Guardian article, and you didn't sue those people. So we don't really think that you're serious about defending your reputation. We think you're just trying to pursue a vendetta against the HSE, so we're throwing out the case. So the work that I had done to some extent kind of helped somebody else whose life was being made hell by this guy.
Yeah, so that's an even happier ending, I suppose,
yes,
for the other people. And so what for you is the most sort of difficult material that you've written about on your blog that you felt sort of most worried about?
Probably with the Trafigura case, because so for people who don't spend all their time thinking about this,
if they're listening to this, they probably have.
Okay, so of course the situation was that the Trafigura had taken out a super injunction to stop the media. Well, they were trying to use this super injunction to stop the media from reporting on a parliamentary question that had been asked about their relationship with the media. And it was reported on the Guardian website, and I immediately, it caught my eye, and I kind of did a bit of digging and found the parliamentary question and put it on Twitter and also put it on my website. And that became quite a big news story. Lots of other people had picked it up. I got there just marginally before, I think, Guido Fawkes got there.
He linked to you, which is the other thing?
I don't know, actually. Oh. But it was an interesting, fascinating thing to be part of. I don't regret doing it, but I sort of realised a few days later that I could have been prosecuted for contempt of court if a court had found that actually the super injunction was valid and did apply, because if it wouldn't have just applied to the Guardian, it would also have applied to any blogger. So in principle, that would have been a criminal offence. That wouldn't have just been libel. That would have been going to prison, potentially.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's this whole big discussion around libel reform, and we've seen big campaigning going on around that. But contempt of court is another whole very murky area when it comes to online. And certainly I've seen, from as a comment moderator, lots of difficult issues. And you're thinking, well, if I allow this, then definitely I'll be in contempt. And that's quite scary because that's a prison sentence.
It is. On the plus side, you get a lot of time to write, which is something I do struggle with, and you wouldn't be constantly connected to the internet, so you might actually get something done.
So let's move to Connie. Connie, you're working on a libel reform seminar at the moment and talking to lots of lawyers, and you've obviously got an interest in libel reform and come from a science background. What are your biggest concerns about the current libel laws and for scientists and for researchers?
I think my interest stemmed from the Simon Singh case, which has now been resolved, but it just seems very difficult for science journalists to say things about the scientific process, which is meant to be peer-reviewed and validated, without sort of getting into trouble. And I've been talking a bit to Peter Wilmshurst, who is also having a problem. Dr. Peter Wilmshurst is based at Shrewsbury Hospital in the UK, and he's been looking at a device which is allegedly not as safe as the company makes out. And for both of these two, one's a doctor, the other one's a journalist, it seems to be the amount of time that this goes on for. I mean, Simon has lost two and a half years of his life, an awful lot of money, which he probably won't get back. Peter Wilmshurst spends all of his evenings and all of his weekends working on this. They have terrific lawyers, but the amount of time that they have to spend doing this. And for Peter Wilmshurst's case, some of it is, I would say, just bullying. I mean, he was served his notice on the day before Christmas, so he couldn't get any advice for 2 weeks. And I think it's really important that scientists like Peter Wilmshurst can turn around and say, there is a problem with this, and we know that there is a problem with this, without having to worry about the power of libel falling upon them. Is libel science a special case? I've thought about this quite a lot of times, because I used to think it was, and recently I was at a science government discussion about this very thing, and actually I don't think it is. I mean, I think there's something about science that is special, and so the sort of keep libel out of science conversation that was going was one that I thought, I'm not quite sure about, because I do think it's the same old things that affect the people. It's the length of time, it's the costs, it's how these processes are dragged out by people who can bring the weight of money and lawyers against. Those are the themes. And I think, you know, if it had happened to Richard's case or to science, you know, in all the cases you can look at, I mean, some of them are science and medical, but I think their commonality is the same, and it's something that we need to worry about more across the board. So actually, whilst I'm concerned about science libel, I'm actually broadening this symposium out to look at the whole of the law and what can be done.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, I mean, when Index on Censorship and English Pen published their report, and Sense About Science, sorry, contributed to it last year, they were looking also, you know, in looking at authors and how they were affected as well. But I think science for them has been a useful community to engage with, and these are people.
Yeah, you could never anticipate that the momentum would have gathered around science. You know, nobody, I mean, I find that extraordinary. This has been a situation that's been going on for years and years, and who'd have said the sort of the touch paper would be science? I'm pleased it was, because it, you know, actually, I think it made it much clearer for people, the general public, to understand what was going on. But I think, I think it's now got to open up and be a bit more general again.
So with the Simon Singh case, people that weren't necessarily scientists were also interested in that, and that's been sort of interesting to observe. And how Simon handled his case was very different from how defendants might have done in the past, and that's been interesting to see how that's all grown up around it. I mean, you're running a science journalism MA here. I mean, how much legal training are you giving your students, or what sort of?
The students at City in General do a massive amount of law now, and it's very, very rigorous. And after they've done all the basics, we start failing or passing them on the work that they do, depending on whether it's legal. And so that's a really important part of what we're doing here. They've got to know their law, they're examined in it. They get lectures from, you know, really senior media lawyer, and they've just got to really get their heads around it. I mean, we're teaching them, so of course we always double check anything we're publishing that they've written. But yeah, it's really critical, and I suppose the big worry for the bloggers out there, the citizen journalists who think we'll just go on and blog, and they don't quite understand. I mean, as journalists, you have to know your law. But there's a very unmediated world out there, which I think is really important, called citizen journalism, that they need to worry about as well.
And of course, it does fall under the same law. And that sort of brings us on to the question of, you know, are bloggers aware of the kind of laws that are out there? Richard, you've engaged a lot with sort of blogging communities. Mm. Do you think people are aware of the dangers of what they write and what could happen to them?
I think people are. I think a lot of people, I mean, most people have a fairly strong instinct for self-preservation, so I've read a lot of people who are doing, you know, useful things, but I can see that they're erring on the side of caution because they don't know what they don't know, which is a perfectly rational response. But it's also a way that you can see how the kind of culture of self-censorship kind of grows and grows and grows, and then they see other people doing it, and so I think that actually the perception of what it's possible to say and get away with is possibly even on average a bit more extreme than the law allows, but obviously people can't really afford to get too close to the line.
Yeah, I think that chill effect is quite serious, and it's a very difficult thing to measure how it affects the way people write, but I think it's quite substantial in how it, if somehow we could measure it and look at what journalists could write and what they don't write, I think would be a very interesting study.
I mean, of course, for journalists based in large organisations, they might be able to go to their lawyer and, for the purpose of insurance, you know, check what they should do in that situation. But, you know, as a one-man blogger, yeah. I mean, obviously, when in your case, it's interesting because you were with a publisher, so that was a sort of slightly different scenario. Mm. But if it was tomorrow that, you know, a legal letter arrives in your email inbox for your blog, Richard, would you immediately seek formal legal advice, or how would you deal with that?
Well, that's not a hypothetical question. I had two.
Oh, right.
So I've actually had three in total in the last 18 months. I had two, other than the book-related ones, specifically for things on my blog, one from a Tory MP and one from a Times freelance journalist. And in both cases, I just took the post down immediately. The reason for that was I didn't want to incur the expense of having to get legal advice. I thought this was a safe enough, in the absence of legal advice, this was the safest thing to do. And thirdly, in that both instances, I didn't feel that particular issue was so overwhelmingly important that I had to stand and fight. But I would do it on a case-by-case basis. There are certain issues that are very personal to me that I would happily stand and fight on, and I would go bankrupt. But you really want to pick your battles, don't you?
I think that, I mean, the response is always, I think, as a blogger, to take the thing down, even if you want to think about whether you want to put it back up again, because at least in law you've shown that at the first moment you got it down. I think, though, there's a wider question, which is how... So many, you talk to Simon Singh, you talk to Peter Wilmshurst, and they talk about, they're so, when they're going through the process, that they just want to cave in and say, yeah, mea culpa. And I think that's a different story because, you know, yeah, if you're smart enough, you get it down and do some thinking. And, you know, in Rich's case, you can think, yeah, this is the battle I want to fight. But actually, I bet if he was halfway through that battle, he'd probably think, I'm going to throw this towel in. This is an enormous pressure. And apart from the costs and the time, it is that personal pressure that's really, really difficult.
And that's what you hear time and time again when I've been to lots of events, hearing defendants explaining their experiences, and it is that pressure and sort of on their family life, on that, you know, their home life, very damaging. But so what happened in those cases, Richard? Did they just go away? It's an 18-month period, you said. And
yeah, I mean, I had... the first one was actually quite well documented. Tony Baldry, MP... it's been talked about online. I basically was covering a story that had been in The Independent, and it was about the relationship between Tony Baldry MP and a Nigerian politician called James Ibori. And I saw that The Independent had issued a correction and apology for something that they'd said about Tony Baldry. And for me, that's always a sort of interesting side. So I went digging, and I found loads of stuff on other blogs that was much more extreme than The Independent had written. So I made reference to those allegations, and I think I made it clear that they were allegations. And then a few days later, I got a letter from Ulswang saying that this was all very defamatory, and I didn't reply, I just took it down. But I also let it be known to a friend of mine, David Alan Green, that this had happened, and also Craig Murray found out that it had happened, and they picked it up, and they Craig Murray doesn't care. He just says what he thinks.
So for anyone that doesn't know who Craig Murray is, I mean, I think there's lots of legal battles you can trace on his blog.
If you Google Craig Murray, you'll find out. I mean, he kind of picked it up, and he said things that were far more hardline than what I'd said. And then David Alan Green went to the other extreme and just wrote a very, very elegantly careful article in The Lawyer, which didn't paint Tony Baldry in a particularly good light, but have been actionable. So I would say it backfired, even though I took the blog post down, the story got out in other ways.
So that's interesting, because David Alan Green is someone that he writes, or he's just renamed it, but it was the Jack of Kent blog, and I think he's now writing under his own name, but he does get involved via Twitter, via his blog, in that conversation, and certainly has worked pro bono, I think, on certain occasions.
Yes.
So he's almost, you know, looking to the community for advice as well, I suppose, is a new phenomenon.
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't a legal advice relationship. I mean, he wrote about it as a blogger and sort of freelancer on, and actually he wrote about it in The Lawyer magazine rather than
online media.
That was his main focus. So that was kind of interesting, because he's someone who bridges now both the online world and the mainstream media in quite an interesting way.
Mm. Certainly at the heart of a lot of legal battles, and he does write very clearly, I think, on his blog, and sort of explains a lot of issues, and certainly I think Simon Singh case was one of the key communicators in that as well. Right, I think we're sort of going to have to wrap it up quite soon, but should we just end on one question? I think, do you think, on the anonymity thing, which mainstream media journalists often get very angry about, just seeing like comments appearing with no sort of name attached to it, you know, against the sort of byline tradition, Do you think, you know, from what you've seen online, that it would help if everyone put their name to everything? Would it reduce the sort of the legal battles that go on and things?
I think it would help. It's hard to say what the world would look like if people were trying not to be anonymous anymore. I think it encourages people to be more responsible, because it encourages you to develop an online persona, which, even if it's totally separate from your real life, it's something that people can hold you to account for. Whereas if you're changing your name every single time you make a comment, then people can't track back and see that you've contradicted yourself or anything like that. I think it's healthy. And I think we still, you know, for all the problems with the law, we still live in a country where you aren't going to be taken out and shot. So most most people, I mean, some people have a very good reason to be anonymous, but I think in most cases, if you've got something to say, you should be able to put your name to it.
What about you, Connie? Do you feel more comfortable reading something where it's got someone's name underneath it?
Or? Very much so. As a journalist, I wouldn't ever not use my name. I think it's really important for me to be able to stand behind my work. Yeah.
OK, well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.